There are some important things we want to look at concerning clearing our conscience. You know, there's a question that we ask counselees, and it would be this. It would be, you know, as you look over your past, are there things that have taken place that you greatly regret? And most everybody can say yes. And the second question is, would you be willing to share those? Because what they're going to do is identify the guilt in their life. And guilt really needs to be dealt with. Because if we don't deal with guilt, it'll eventually just destroy us as bitterness destroys us. We want to also talk about how to make things right. And when do you make things right? And is it ever right not to make things right? You know, I know people that tried to make things right and made it worse. We would have this happen so often, and we try to share and clarify. And so we really want to clarify with you some things. There's some things you don't share and some things that you do share. The one thing that's wrong to share is the details of things done in secret. For it's a shame even to speak of those things which are done in them in secret in Ephesians. So you don't share details of immorality. You just don't do that. As I was growing up, our family were social drinkers. And I mean the whole family that I grew up in, my father's side. Eventually, it went from social drinking to drinking problems. And many of my aunts and uncles developed drinking problems, including my father. And so as I moved into the most important years of my life, I think from my perspective, which would be the teen years, although I think the younger years are more important, but the teen years are the more important to a child than when they're little, and yet the little years prepare them, my dad began losing a battle with a bottle. And we had an alcoholic for a father. And if you've grown up in that situation, you know the traumas of living with an alcoholic. It's a very terrible thing. And you ought to just, if you know any young people that are whose parents are alcoholics, you ought to really pray for them. Because you know nothing of the emotional strain the child's under. When the parents are drinking, there's fighting, there's all kinds of things that are taking place. You never know what they're going to be like. Every day when we come home from school, my dad was the first one home. Sometimes he'd be there when we got out of junior high and high school. And you wonder, will he be drunk? How drunk will he be? Will he be mean? Will he be nasty? Will he say terrible things and all of this kind of a thing? And so I was not very long in my teen years when resentments began to build in my heart. And I resented my father. And things got worse. It moved from resentment to hate. I know I hated him. I wouldn't want to say I hated him, but I did hate him. And I'm sure I hated more what he was doing than him. But when you're a teenager, you don't separate that kind of thing. You know, you just have those feelings, and you just feel very bad. And it got to the place that I was positive that I was adopted. God would never have put me in a home like this. So they adopted me, and that was a comfort, because one day I was going to find the papers and know that I wasn't a part of that mess. You know, and it was just going to really make me feel good. And that's what I lived with, the thought that I wasn't born into this family, which is a tragedy as I was growing up. In fact, things got so bad and I was so unhappy that between 15 and 16, I figured out a way to commit suicide, stayed home from school to do the suicide, and the rifle was gone. I figured out that I could either stick my thumb in and pull the trigger. I could put the barrel in my mouth, you know, and if I could put my thumb, and I thought, well, what if it isn't long enough, since I hadn't tried it out to see if it was, I could put my toe in there and shoot. I had it all planned. I went off to school, walked around the block, waited till I saw my mother go to work, my dad go to work, came home, went in the house, got the bullets down, went in my dad's closet, which was a walk-in closet, which was unusual in those days, walk-in closet, way around back, and the rifle was gone. And I couldn't find it, and I searched, and it ruined everything. And, I mean, it just really did. I was depressed. I couldn't do anything right. I couldn't even kill myself right. And I couldn't even find a gun to do it. And I was so down. Well, I got over that, and so I went into another form of death. How do you suppose the that I thought would be a wise way to escape an alcoholic? By drinking. So I became a teenage drinker. And whenever my dad would do things I'd get mad at, I'd leave the home with the purpose of getting drunk. Now, wasn't that wise? Going to establish the same lifestyle and pattern by the time I started my family as he was, and be just as, you know, raising as miserable kids feeling as he did. Well, I became a Christian, and that should have really done something. But what it did, it caused me to look down on my father. Not only was he an alcoholic, but now he was a dirty sinner. And so I had an attitude now that he had a godly son living in a very ungodly home. And you want to be careful about exalting teenagers for suffering for righteousness. Because I remember I was reading my Bible right there in the living room or somewhere and quoting my scriptures and all of this. And my dad had gotten, you know, he said, when you were a sinner, I'm sure inside, you made me sick. But now that you have God on your side, you make me more sick, you know, with his pseudo-righteousness and all of this. I remember my dad came in, he took the Bible and he threw it. He said, if you ever read this book in this house again, you know, if you ever read this again, you're out. And he threw it against the wall. Well, I went and I shared. Remember when I saved by the navigators, and I shared with the navigators. Do you know that my father's refused to? And they just, you know, they picked up on that. You know, this young man, dad threw his Bible against the wall. He said he couldn't read the Bible. You know, isn't that glorious? And my dad, I was being persecuted for crummy attitudes. They didn't realize that because I was telling one story outside. But I look back on it now, and I just could see that I was the greatest hindrance in my dad's life to become a Christian because I was such a poor Christian, and I was the best Christian he knew. And so after I was a Christian and I became went to Bible school, I asked my mom. I said, Mom, I'd ask her this all the time anyway. I said, does my dad care about me? And she said, yes. I said, why hasn't he ever said so? She says, I don't know. He just doesn't say things very easy like that. So when I was going to Bible school, my dad was saying to people that he was so proud, and yet all he would do is put me down in his presence. When I graduated from Bible school, he came to the graduation. I was just thrilled. I thought, now he's going to tell me, you know, son, I really am proud that you graduated from college. Never said anything. And I was so disappointed and, you know, more bitter and resentful. But being a Christian now, I was treated him different. And we got into our pastorate. I thought, surely he's going to say something positive. He didn't. And we would go down and visit him, and my dad and I would always argue. I'd walk into my dad's presence, and my stomach would turn over. I would just get sick because we'd have a big argument about whatever. He'd take the other side. And if you've ever lived an alcoholic, I'm telling you a story of what every young person goes through in a home of an alcoholic. If you say it's white, they'll say it's black. You say it's green, they'll say it's blue. You say it's blue, they'll say it's green. There's just no way. It was just hassle after hassle. From the pastorate, we'd go down visiting on our vacation. My dad and I would have, as long as we were watching TV, everything went great. I just thank God for TV. You know, you don't have to communicate. You just sit there and look at it. And we could handle that. But it was when there was nothing to watch and we had to talk, we had a problem. And we would just react to each other, and I'd get up and walk out with my family, pack up the car, just say, why did we ever come here? Why did I come back after a year? I should have known not to come down here to visit. I just can't handle my dad. He's always putting me down, and I just can't take that. He makes me feel so inferior, and I don't like that feeling. And he is not pleased with me, and I tried so hard to please him, and it was just a terrible year after year after year after year. And finally, I was confronted with my attitudes. I was confronted with what I had done wrong in this home. I was always focusing on how he had failed. Someone had me confront on how I had failed. And I began to look back on my teenage years. And I began to think, would I want my son to respond to me the way I responded to my father? And I looked at my things that I said and how I looked down my nose at my father and all of that kind of thing. And I thought, it's no wonder he drank when he had a teenager like me. I sure didn't help anything. I'm sure I put a lot of pressures and struggles on his life, and he had to deal with this kid that he was struggling with. And so as I began to realize all the things that I had done wrong, I purposed in my heart that I was going to clear my conscience with my father. And I was going to make things right between me and him, as far as I could, my wrong with him. And my dad was, and I'm not saying this in a wrong way, but my dad was a lot more wrong than I was. I was a kid, and I was responding wrong. and I was wrong. And that's how I justified it. Look, he's 90% wrong. I was just 10% wrong. And my 10% isn't all that important. It was, because it was destroying my effectiveness as a pastor. I had all kinds of problems in my early Christian life as a pastor. I could not take pressures. I couldn't stand people I didn't know. It was so bad, I can't tell you, the inferiority that I struggled with was so bad that I went to my first pastor's conference in Salem, Oregon. It was an IFCA pastor's conference, and I went to that to see if I would want to join with other pastors. And they came, and because I was a visiting pastor, they asked me to lead the singing to a group not even as big as this, probably as big as this group over here, of pastors in that area. And they said, would you lead singing? And I said, no. And they said, you're kidding. You, of course you would lead singing. I said, if you push it, I'll go home. I mean, that's how I was struggling. If they'd have made me get up in front of a group this big, I would have left. I couldn't stand it. I couldn't take it. Because I couldn't stand if they would have rejected me. What if they didn't like me? You know, what did I look like and how were they perceiving me? I couldn't handle that. I hated three things: Christmas, Easter, and funerals. Funerals especially. Because we had funerals in this little dinky, God put me in the smallest town there was in California, I think, the pastor. He said, there's no other place smaller, Logan, to start out than there. 350 people with 18 miles around, you know, you can't get much smaller than that. Little country church. And yet when someone would die, they bring the body to church and all 350 people would come. So that church that sat about 100. They would be all over the place. People would be out in the back of the church standing, and they'd be outside. They put microphones so people are standing outside. They couldn't get in the building. And I'd have to get up there and preach. I would be so sick at home that I feel like throwing up. I tell my wife, oh, I just can't stand it. I just can't do it. She says, Jim, you've got to. Well, I said, I can't. I can't do another funeral. I just can't face all those strangers. What will they think of me? You know, what if these people didn't like what I said? What if I preached the gospel and they got offended? And I'd preach the gospel and they'd get offended and I would die inwardly. I mean, I wouldn't, you know, outwardly, but inwardly I'm dying because they're reacting. Don't react. You know, don't reject me. I've been rejected all of my life. Please don't reject me. I can't take that. It was horrible cycles and things I was going through. I can't tell you. And if I never handled it, I'd still be there. Now, I still would be in that little place and probably dying, you know, if more than 30 people came to church. I was the only one that didn't want a growth. It's not funny. I, you know, you can laugh, but I was dying. That's terrible. It was terrible. I can identify with people that have terrible self-images, and all of this I can identify because I've been there. And one day we were driving home from our church, and I preached on my attitudes towards my father in hell, that I needed to get right with him, and I had planned to get right with him. But I wanted to wait till I could see him. I wanted my dad to see in my face that I was really, truly sorry for the way I had responded to his authority and the way I had treated him as a teenager and as a son. And I knew I had been a great disappointment to him. And so we were driving home. We were living in Tacoma, Washington then, and pastoring the church that Christine's dad had just left. And I followed Christine Bradley, who works here at Home Office. I followed her father as the pastor of that church. I left that little church. I could handle crowds of 30 and 40, so I got to the bigger town and the bigger church. But I was still struggling with inferiority and insecurity. And we were driving home, and my wife says, Jim, I really feel that you ought to ask your dad's forgiveness. Around Easter time, my message was on the forgiveness of God and how we ought to forgive people. And I said, you know, I'm just going to wait a few months till summer, and then I'll tell my dad. I think it'd be better. And we went home, and we were eating, and the phone rang right in the middle of the meal. And it was my father. Now, my father never called because we couldn't talk. You know, when I ever met anybody that was drinking, I would go to the Skid Row missions to preach, and I would see these people. And you know what I saw? 50 of my fathers sitting there. And I couldn't love these men because I would react to them. My stomach would turn. This church that Christine's dad had pastored and I had pastored was in an upper-class neighborhood in Tacoma. And I remember going calling, and we would meet people at the cocktail hour. And I could not share Christ with them when I would see that glass. I would just react to anyone that reminded me of any of my unhappy childhood or anything that with my father and his drinking. I just could not. It was involuntary. I would just turn over. Well, it was my dad, and he never called because we couldn't talk. So I knew God had had him call. And so I knew this was the time. And so I told my dad, I said, you know, Dad, I've been recently looking back over my life. And when I realize how much I deeply have hurt you by not responding to your authority, and I named the different things that I could see, major things, I said, Dad, would you forgive me? And he said, son, you know, kids are kids. I knew then that I'd hurt him deeper than what I knew. Because, you know, he couldn't come up with, I forgive you. See, I've been a pastor now at least 10 years. I was in my 30s. And I said, Dad, I just can't tell you how much I know I hurt you. Could you and would you forgive me? And he said, yes, son, I forgive you. And then he put my mom on. I asked her forgiveness because my mom was sort of second-handed hurt by my bad, but I treated my mother right. The very next week or the following week, my dad wrote me a letter. You know what he said in that letter? Dear son, I just wrote to tell you how much I appreciate you and what you're doing with your life and so on. That summer, in August, my dad called and asked if he could fly up and visit us. I said, I couldn't believe that. My dad was so insecure, he would never fly without my mother. My mother is very sure of herself, and my dad was getting more and more unsure the older he got. And I said, Dad, sure, come on up. And we went out to SeaTac to get my dad, and you know how they come up those things, and they turn the corner. And when he turned the corner, I saw him for the first time, and it had been Easter, around Easter time, when I asked his forgiveness. It was in August when I saw him again. And when I saw him, I stood there, and I couldn't believe it. But guess what happened? Something happened inside of me that had never happened for as long as I can remember. First of all, my stomach did not turn over. The second thing, I loved him. God had put a love in my heart when I saw him. I just couldn't believe it. I'm standing there and saying, you know, I love him. I feel it. You know, I almost became quite carried away. I was really excited. You know, I couldn't believe it because it was of God. Because every time I'd seen him before, I just turned over. This time I didn't turn over. I had a love for my dad. And we spent a tremendous week in our home. And the second night he flew up with my sister's oldest boy, 15. The second night at devotions, my sister's oldest boy said, could I become a Christian? And we led him to Christ. He went home and led his brother to Christ, and he's led just hundreds of Christ to Christ, and he's going to be a detective in Los Angeles on the police force, and it's just been phenomenal. He went in a Bible church, found a church. He called on the phone. He said, you guys preach the Bible there? he said, my uncle doesn't want me to go to a church unless it preaches the Bible, you know. And he went to that church, and in Orange County, he's been there, and now he's a deacon in that church, just as a high school kid, and he's gone on with the Lord, and it's just, his life has touched so many. And my dad sat there while I led him to the Lord. Well, at Christmas time, and I remember it was Saturday, and that was Christmas Eve. Christmas was on a Sunday that year. My wife called, and I was at the church, and she said, Jim, sit down. I have something terrible to tell you. And I sat down, and she said, your mom came home and found your dad dead on the floor. And so the day after Christmas, you know, you've ever opened Christmas presents from a dead person? Talk about hard. And we had to have Christmas. We had the children. And then we flew down to the funeral, and my dad had five sisters, and they were all there at the funeral, and I went up to each one of them separately to tell them that I had made things right. They knew things were bad. And I said, you know, I wanted you to know that before Dad died, I'd ask his forgiveness. And Dad came to see us, and they said, yes. The first hand said, yes. Do you know what he said? I said, no. They said, your dad said, it was the most wonderful week of his life. And you know what the tragedy is? He only had one week, one good week with his son, and I was the Christian. That I had probably been a Christian 14 years before I cleared up what I had done wrong. And I thought, why? I was thankful I did it before he died. I wish I had done it years before. But, you know, no one ever told me, and I didn't really understand that. That doesn't give me an out. I'm just telling you the truth. I didn't know that a Christian should take care of what they did wrong. I did with God, but I didn't know a Christian should clear their conscience with man. No one ever had told me that. I had never seen it in the Word. So we need to clear our conscience. How do we do it? I want to share some things here. There are some things people have asked me, and I've been really thrilled with the response to counseling, and I'm sorry that all the times were filled up and we didn't have time for all of you. And I really feel bad about that. Those who wanted to talk that couldn't get on the list because they were all filled in. A rule of thumb, and this usually works, the circle of confession should be no larger than the circle of offense. It's like, you know, part of the problem, part of the solution. You want to be careful. You say, well, let's say that I have some feelings towards Julian's sweeper that I ought to sweep out of my life. And because I'm sleeping on the same mattress that I had last year when I was here. But see, he's not aware that I'm struggling. If the person's not aware of it, then my offense is only towards what? God. And I ought to take care of it with the Lord. That's it. I need to go up to you and say, you know, Julian, I really have some bad attitudes towards you. Would you forgive me? Because I'm giving him some problems. Now he's wondering, what did he do and why and all this stuff. And he wasn't aware of it. Do you see? If the person's not aware of the offense, then you don't share it with them. You just share it with God. That's all it needs to be. If the sin was between you and God, you take care of it between you and God, and that's all there is. And you don't need to bring others in. But when the sin is against a brother, or sin is against someone else, then I have a responsibility to go to that person and clear it up with them and with God. As Paul said, it was important. But there are four things I need to do before I ask forgiveness. The first thing is, I need to ask myself, do I need to change my behavior? See, you can ask somebody to forgive you again and again and again and again and again. And after a while, they say, why don't you just change and stop asking? Right? You know, honey, forgive me for leaving my socks on the floor. Well, she'd much rather you pick them up. You know, just do it. And you got to do that, you know. The second thing is there restitution involved in this? Is there something I need to give back more than just words? I need to figure out what maybe I need to do, my responsibility in that. The third is, have I tried to put myself in the other person's shoes so I can understand how they feel? That's important. Because the more I can understand how I hurt them, the more sincere and genuine my words can be. Do you see that? You know, you can come off and ask for, maybe you hurt somebody very deeply. You stuck a knife in their heart and you twisted it. And then you go and you come off with, you know, sorry about that, would you forgive me? And there's no genuine heartbrokenness in that. And they want a sense that your heart is broken. And the last question to ask myself, have I really fully forgiven them? Have I really asked God to take all that out of my heart, all the bitterness, and have I really forgiven them? Now, we're not talking about the feelings. We're just talking about, have I really forgiven them? The second major section is some of the things I need to ask myself so I can work out what I'm going to say to them. First of all, have I identified what offended them most? You know, I may have offended them, but what really do I think that hurt them the deepest? Instead of asking for something little here, I could have gone to my dad and say, Dad, you remember when I was 12 and slammed the bedroom door? Would you forgive me? It was a lot more than slamming a bedroom door, let me tell you. And I realized that it needed to be general because I wanted to clear up the whole past. The second was, does my wording put blame on them or someone else? I had kids at college this is what I'm teaching you was what we taught to the freshmen at Calvary in a character class. And one of the students, they come and say, you know, I asked my parents, forgive me, and they hung up the phone. And I said, well, what did you say? And they said, well, I said, you know, when I was growing up, I had a rotten attitude, and so did you, and then, man, you know, and it was all over with. Or something like that, you know. I'm going, oh, how could you do that? You know, you'd have been better off not calling to do something like that. So you're not to imply blame, you know. Well, Dad, you remember when you had your real drinking problem? Well, I had a real hard time responding to you like I should when you were drunk. And, well, you know, that would have been what? You know, I know that's being really strong, but people do very innuendos. And it really, the person that they're talking to really is reacting inwardly to what they're saying. You just want to assume 100% for what you did wrong and not what they've done wrong. You know, honey, I'm sorry I argued with you. Why don't you learn to keep your mouth shut and I wouldn't have to ask your forgiveness? No, I'm wrong for arguing regardless. You know, the third, am I trying to justify what I did in any way? You know, what I say to them is it sound like I'm trying to justify? And this is very, very important. Don't preach at this time. This is not the time to witness about eternity. Now, if they ask you for the reason that's hope that's in you, you give it with meekness and fear. But if they don't ask you, this is not the time to talk about eternal things. You're clearing something up, let the Spirit of God work, and later on talk to them. But not at this time. It usually does not work. And this is important. They're all important, but this one. Is my confession, directly or indirectly, trying to get them to change? You know, if I confess this, then they'll treat me better. You know, am I trying to be manipulative? Am I trying to manipulate my mom, my dad, my wife, my children by doing what God says here to bring about something beneficial for me? Don't manipulate them or try to get them to change. When you and I have an internal balance, an emotional balance, and it doesn't take a whole lot to get our emotional scale off balance. If I do something that violates Scripture or my cultural teachings or my parental teachings or what the Bible says, I will sense in my spirit guilt. And when I feel guilty, my emotional scale just goes like this. Well, you cannot stand feeling guilty all the time. You'll break down. So I've got to balance my scale out. Now, how do I balance my scale out so I can try and have an emotional stability? What do I put on the other side of the scale when I feel guilty? Blame. The reason I did this is this. And so I try to balance this out in my life. In clearing your conscience, you're getting rid of the blame because you don't need it anymore when you deal with the guilt. It's both gone. So it's very important, and then everything is going to be okay. So I want to work out my wording, and usually the best is calling. A visit is difficult because after you ask forgiveness, then what do you say? You know, you got some very difficult moments there. So visiting isn't a good idea. You say, well, what about writing a letter? Some have even talked to me here. They've written letters. Guess what happens when you write someone a letter, usually asking them to forgive you? You never hear from them. You don't know if they did. You don't even know if they got the letter. You don't know anything. But sometimes the letter is the only way you can go. But the letter is better than a visit, usually. Now, you know, if God led me to do a visit, I felt led to do a visit, but God gave me a phone instead. Phone is usually the best because you can state the purpose of the call. I am calling, and this is why. And then you can, you know, after they say yes, say, well, I really appreciate that, and thank you so much, and hang up, then you can call it another time for a visit. But it's usually quite an emotional struggle at the time. I mean, it's emotional for you, it can be emotional for them. Because if you ask someone to forgive you, and they forgive you, what are they all of a sudden left with? A lot of guilt. Because, see, they may have been blaming you for a lot of their actions. And if they forgive you, then they're struggling. Because the very thing that they're holding, now there's nothing there. And their guilt becomes all that much more real. So a lot of things go on inside of a person, and a phone is usually the best way to go. The word sorry is not usually a good word to use. You know, I'm sorry about that, because you know what people say that, you know, they bump you sorry about that. It just doesn't convey with you the depth that you want to get across to a person that you've deeply hurt. So wrong is a good word. It's very difficult. I was wrong. I hate that word. I don't like to say it. I just recently had gotten very, very upset with my son. And said some things I shouldn't have said. I attacked his character instead of his behavior. I just let it fly. And he left and went up to his room. He was really good about it. We've got too good of a son for us. He is just such a neat kid. And in so many ways, he reproves me. Not verbally, but just like responding right when I'm wrong. And I want the kid to answer back or something, you know. And he does right, you know, and it does feel terrible. And I remember I had said things I shouldn't have, and I was upset and all of this. And I had to go up to his room and say, "Richard, I was wrong. Would you forgive me?" And a trip to his room or to my wife or my daughter's is never easy. Never easy. It's just so hard. I think, "Logan, why don't you learn not to say it, and then you won't have to go take the trip?" You know, it's so much easier not to violate. But, you know, can we live together and not hurt somebody? I don't think we can, because we're people. We don't want to. You know, God doesn't say plan to fail, but he says, "I have a plan when you fail." And there's a difference, isn't there? To plan to fail and then to follow 1 John 1:9 when you do. And so don't plan to fail, but fail. When you do fail around here or wherever you're failing, stop and ask, you know, do you need to go to that secretary and say something? Do you need to go to a man in leadership here and share with him that you were wrong and ask if he would forgive you? And, you know, it's such a motivation to be so careful, or a lot more careful, about what we say and what we do so that we don't have to go. Because it's not, if it's easy for you to do, I doubt the genuineness of your getting right. I doubt if you're really sorry. And you need to ask God to break your heart. You need to get along, Lord, break my heart with this sin. Now let me see the hurt I've done. And, Lord, help me to get it right. Now, after asking forgiveness, some things I need to do. I need to ask myself, what will I do if they won't forgive me? You know, if they won't forgive you, what usually is that a sign of? They're hurt deeper than what you even realized. They're hurt a lot more than what you ever realized. And it's just hard for them to forgive you. And you could say, you know, I realized how deeply I hurt you. You know, would you forgive me? If they say, I could never forgive you, you say, I am so sorry that I hurt you so deeply. I mean, let them know that you know how deeply you hurt them and you're so sorry. But if they don't, and I want to say this in the most loving way, and I think I said it before, Verna Berkey says this. She says some excellent, significant things in her work. One of the things, Verna Berkey says this, when you and I have done right, and the person that we've ministered to refuses to do what's right, then that's their problem. It's no longer your problem. You can't go on being guilty because you tried to make things right and they refused. Then they're resisting God's grace, and it's their problem now. Because you did all that you need to, you know, be sure you said everything in a right way and you didn't offend them in that. But there are some people that will say, no, I will never forgive you. I know a fellow went to a pastor, and the pastor said, I would never forgive you, never, for what you've done. Well, that's terrible. But, I mean, that's facts. What do you do? Well, you know, you must have, you know, how awful you must have hurt them, but there's nothing much more you can do. The second thing, you know, to be sure I really sincerely thank them for forgiving me if they do, that we really let them know how much we appreciate their forgiveness. The fourth one is, am I prepared for no change in their behavior towards me? What if they never change? And the last one, I'll give it as illustration. When our children are growing up, it's very easy for us to wound their spirit. Proverbs says, a brother offended is harder to be won than a walled city. Proverbs also says, a wounded spirit, who can bear? Proverbs also says that, I can't think of it, it's about the heart now, the verse just slipped my mind. A heart knows its own bitterness. And so when we hurt someone, we can hurt them very, very deeply. And when we do, we build walls. And when we build in our family, when there's wounded spirits in the family, it is usually the reproof or the visual thing that you can sense is a breakdown in communication. Because you're building a wall between the spirits of people. And we were working with our children on an individual basis, building spiritual things in their life through notebooks and things. And as I was working, one of our daughters, I sensed, had a wounded spirit. And we were having the spiritual times together. I made appointments with each one of the children for an hour to build into their spirit as their father. And this one daughter was not responding to me like the other ones were. And she was not bad. And she did more Bible and all of this, but I could sense you can sense when your spirits click. You ever have an intimate time with your kids? You know, it's just a neat time, and you know it's a neat time. You can just sense it. You can't explain it. You can't put it in words. But there was a closeness, and you can sense that. Well, I didn't have it with this girl. And at spiritual times should be close times, and it wasn't. And so I got alone with the Lord, and as I asked the Lord to help me to look back over her childhood, and as I looked back over her childhood, I saw times that I got angry, and I attacked her character instead of her behavior. I remember one time I slapped her on the face because I was so angry. That was when I was having all my frustrations over being inferior and all of that. And I remember hitting her in the church, and I remember telling her, what will the church people think if you do this? I hope you never say that to your kids. Because someday, you know what they're going to say? Who cares what they think? It's what God thinks that counts, not what the church people think. But I was all wrecked. See, I was having so many struggles. It was what people thought was really important, especially the church people. And so I put the kids under pressures they should never have been under. Our kids are really wonderful kids. It's amazing. I mean, if it wasn't for my wife, these kids have been messed up. Some of you know our kids, and they're just lovely, lovely kids, and they really love the Lord and have good testimonies and witnesses and really have a desire to serve the Lord. But, you know, I went through some struggles, and it affects the kids. You know, when we're not right with God and we violate these principles that are on here, it affects our children. Do you know that? Worry, anger, immorality, you name any of those things on there, it's going to affect your family. Just affects the kids. And so I just looked back, and I could see a number of these things that I had failed. I didn't know which one had hurt her the most. She knew. Maybe I made promises. We're going to go see this, and we never went. That wounds a child's spirit. Well, there's just so many things that some fellow says, well, you can't help but wound a kid's spirit. I said, I know it. That's why you ask their forgiveness. It's hard. It's impossible hardly to raise kids and not fail, but make it right. And so I worded it, and this is the wording I use. If you've never asked your kids forgiveness, you may want to write it down because you may need to do it yourself. I said this. I asked her this question. I said, this was for a teenager. This wouldn't use for a little kid, but a teenager. I said, as you look back over your life, does it make you happy or sad? Now, you can put it in your own words. But I was asking that question because I want them to be reflective at that time, and I wanted to review her life. But she did. When you ask someone a question like that, you just review quickly. And she said, neither, Dad. And I said, you know, as I look back over your life, it makes me sad. And she said, why? I said, because I failed you as a father, being a Christian example I should have been to you. Things that I've done that I should never have done as a Christian man. I said, I love you, and would you forgive me? And she was crying by this time, and she said, Dad, I forgive you. And she threw her arms around me, and she gave me a kiss, and I gave her a kiss, and I said, honey, would you pray for me that I would be a better dad? I said, my desire is to be a better dad to you kids. And I said, kids had projects every week that they did in the Bible, and then they would come back, and we'd share together. And I said, your project for this week is not going to be out of the Bible. I want you to go And I want you to come up with 5 ways that I could be a better father to the family. And she looked at me like, if I say it, you'll get mad. Because she knew she had a dad that struggled with inferiority. And her dad was just now starting to make changes in his life. And she said, I said, I really mean it. I said, you can help me to be a better dad to the other kids. You go and you come back and you tell me. And so she did. And so the last point is to ask them to point out blind spots if it's appropriate. You know, ask them to point out blind spots if it's appropriate. But if they do, don't get mad. Or justify it. You know, if they say, well, if you wouldn't, well, I wouldn't if this, you know. And so all of a sudden they're going, oh, no. Why did you ask? Because we're starting to go that whole defensive route again. I think because this one is so essential and people have blown it so much, clearing their conscience, is there any questions? I'd rather answer your questions than have you go out and try to really, you know, get yourself right with God and right with man and blow it if there's something I could answer right now. Because the question you have may be the same one someone else has. Is there any questions you have about clearing your conscience? Okay. Give you just a couple more minutes. You got any questions about clearing your conscience or helping someone else do it? Yes, sir.
You said something. What if they don't react at all? What if they continue on the way they really want to be?
Okay, the question was, what should we do if we ask their forgiveness and there's no changes? Well, you know, one of the greatest things in asking people's forgiveness was, and all I can say is from my own life, is the change that took place in me. So that when they failed, I didn't add it onto my list of 300. I didn't have a 300 list. I got rid of that list. So I could deal with their failures then. It was just one time. See, instead of a whole lot of them. And you can't force. My dad did not stop drinking because I asked his forgiveness. But he had been tapering down by then. But I go to his house and open a can of beer, and I didn't react anymore. I mean, that was between him and God. And I could love him. And I pitied him. I mean, the right kind of pity. I felt sorry for him, a man who was trapped. Before, I never saw him trapped in his own struggles and losing. And so my whole thought towards him was differently, and my dad did not pick me apart anymore. He stopped with his tongue, and he never did that. If he did, it was so insignificant, it just didn't register. But I know people that won't and get angry, and that where you just have to pray God to keep your spirit right. Lord, help me to have a right attitude towards that person. You told me to love my enemies, and this person has become an enemy now. So you're going to have to love that person through me. Now, that's about all you can do, because some people have asked, they said, I'll never forgive you. What you've done, I'd never forgive you. And they avoid you, or they're saying things about you. And it's very difficult. You know, you think you really got a handle on it, and someone comes, you know what so-and-so said about you? And you say, I can hardly wait. You know, in fact, I can wait and wait. Just don't tell me. And they tell you, and then you have to almost deal with it all over again. You say, oh boy, you just rile up inside. You say, how could they do that? I humbled myself, asked their forgiveness, and now they're blasting my character. You know, it's just really difficult. Anyone else? Yes, sir. You will find every dynamite minister has glaring holes if you get to know them. Every one of them. There's not one man that's in a ministry, if you're around him enough, that you can't see Swiss cheese. You know, really, it's just the Spirit of God flowing through all those holes. And well, you can give a good report about the person. The man should have gotten up and given a public apology. To stand up before a group and to give a public apology is probably one of the most difficult things that God will ever ask any individual to do. If you think one-on-one's hard, you should stand up before a large group of people and ask their forgiveness for failing. It is hard. You wish you could die. You wish there was a crack you could just kind of fall in and disappear. Or, you know, I've never prayed for the second coming, you know, as I have for this. And some men aren't big enough. And yet you don't want to undermine his ministry. Because if it's of God, it'll keep on. If it's not of God, don't worry about it. Isn't that right? If God planted it, it'll grow. And then you could just think, you know, praise God. If God can bless this guy, as stinking as he is, there's hope for me, you know? There's hope for me. With the failures he has, you know, then God maybe will use me too. Isn't that encouraging? I mean, somebody ought to write about the holes and the grates, you know, and that may kind of help you. It really may help you. Is there any other question? We'll go on here if there isn't. Yes, ma'am. Yeah, what do you do if you ask forgiveness but you put blame on the other person? Did they get angry? Did the other person get upset about it? I recently come to realize again. That's a hard one. It's harder to make it right a second time, isn't it? You see how hard it is the second time when you didn't do it right the first time. But if the Spirit of God's really moving on you, I would say, you know, I realized I call back. And I just think I didn't convey as I really should have what I'm trying to say. And this is what I'd really like to convey to you, you know, that I was wrong and so on and so forth. And if they say something, I mean, I try to think of what they say. Let's say they said, well, then how come you blamed me before? And you say, you know, I realized that I am responsible to God for what I do. And I wouldn't say you're responsible for what you do because you're doing that. But I'm just responsible to God for what I do. And I was really wrong. You know, and I would just put it on me and not on them. Because God can move you. I mean, if the Lord can move you to do it. And it's amazing, even the timing of it. Pray for the timing. You know, that when you call, that God would be preparing the heart before that call. And, you know, and that the Spirit of God would have the victory in this and the enemy wouldn't get in. And it's a, you know, if Christians would do this on a major thing consistently, it would be so healthy because guilt would be gone. I think most of us talk to God about it, but we're very hesitant about talking to people, the ones that we hurt. Well, I think we need to put our chart back on again because we want to show you some things now about this chart. There are... that one. These five areas, now show them a peacemaker. The peacemaker is one who's willing to go and make things right with everyone they offended, God and man. These five, pride, or the critical spirit, the anxious spirit, the angry spirit, the resentful spirit, the sensual spirit, the condemning spirit, these five things, when they are out of whack, or any part of them are out of whack in our life, are going to have a direct effect on the next three. And if we don't get things right on these five, the bottom three are going to be out of kilter. Now, Stacy, why don't you show us little by little what these bottom three are, and you can get these down. These five are important. Not that these aren't important, but these are definitely affected by the top. This is an apathetic and indifferent spirit. Doesn't that bother you when you share your work with child evangelism to people that are apathetic and indifferent? Isn't that something you talk about, the children that are lost and trying to get people concerned about it, and they could care less about the souls of little children? Doesn't that bother you? Haven't you run across people like that? They could care less. Well, they've got a problem. You know they got a problem, one of the top here. This will show out in a disinterest and irregularity in the devotional life. See, when I have guilt, it affects my power of concentration. When I get alone with God, when I have guilt, what's God going to do? What did David say? When your hand was heavy on me, my moisture was turned to drought, my knees were cracked, God was shoving me down. And that kind of condition is not what you call a devotional condition. You don't even want to get to the Lord, because when you're with the Lord, all he does is condemn you, because God is trying to get you to get things right. And you need to ask yourself right now, and you here are spiritual leaders. I don't care what you do for child evangelism. You tell people out there you work for child evangelism, immediately they think you as what? You're a cut above someone else. Spiritually. I mean, after all, this is a Christian organization. You're in Christianity full time. And people expect that you are at least talking with a head every day and reading his word. And you know that one of the things that can happen, the higher up you get in any Christian organization, the higher up you get, the less time you have to spend time with him. You get so busy and there's so many pressures that pretty soon you don't spend time with him. You don't have a devotional time. Why? You're too busy. That's the justification. I'm just so busy. Or I'm so tired. There's so many problems. There's so many pressures. There's a whole world we're trying to reach. I don't have time to be in the Bible every day. And that's devastating. And these problems will cause you to have that, or you might not choose to because of pressures. God wants us to have a hunger and a thirst for righteousness. David said, as that heart panteth for the water brooks, my soul pants for God. Do you have that kind of a panting for God? Okay, another one stays. A sensitive and bored spirit. And the character deficiency would be a lack of prayer and a lack of purpose. And then the solution would be to mourn, to allow God to break your heart with the things that break his heart. And then really talking about it. When I was at Biola, it was interesting. As we go into the teacher's office, all of them had a little card that was scotch tape on their desk. And it said, why pray when you can worry? You know, and that's so many people, you know, that's it. And we just don't have a prayer. We don't have a burden to pray anymore. You got to check out. Do I have a deficiency in my character that's coming out this way? Another one. The last one is having a spirit of fear. And it causes us to compromise. God has not given us a spirit of fear, but of love and of power and a soundness of mind. And to be willing to be persecuted for righteousness' sake. And if you're going to be a leader, you're going to be persecuted and misunderstood. And some people are not going to be interested in what you're doing and maybe tell you they're not interested in a very forceful way. They're not interested in children. They're not interested in the work that you're doing and feel that they should give to it and so on. Now, these attitudes, I'm sure that you've figured out, are the attitudes that Christ said we were to be. And they're called the Beatitudes. And these are just basic for one who's going to walk with God. A Christian is someone who is getting rid of their pride and has a right value system, and they don't have bitterness, and they've got a handle on their sensuality, and they're not struggling with guilt, and they're having a time in the Word and a time of prayer and a sense of purpose, and are willing to stand for something. That's what a Christian is. Now let's put the integrating qualities on. This was done by 15-year-old fellow, as he saw that other chart, and he tried to, because he was into motors and things, he designed this to try and visualize these different areas. And here you have those five areas we dealt with, and he saw those as the wheels in our life that turn the spiritual drive shaft. And when there's a breakdown of gears, what happens when the gears break down? That doesn't mesh. You know, if, let's say here on the clear conscience, that you need to make things right with the government over a number of years. You only have 3 kids, not 4. And you need to go back and make things right on April 14th. Or you go around, you know, do I have a clear conscience? And if I don't, where's the gears? Where did it break down? What about my motives? What about music that I listen to? You know, does it show a purity of heart? My eating habits, my sex life, the way I dress, the things I say, what I read, the places and entertainment I go, the things I think about. You know, are those things all right? And you could add other things. You know, a denial of self. You know, have I given God my money, my health? That's one thing that's hard to get on the altar is your health, because God may take it. Or any of these other things. You just go around each one of these. And this fellow just tried to put down the things he could see that your forgiving spirit. You know, what about your enemies or friends or parents or brothers and sisters and so on? It's really interesting, I think, how he did it. And we need to check it out. And if we've got a breakdown there, we got a purpose in our heart. Lord, restore the inner drive shaft, or inner gears of my heart and life, so that my spiritual drive shaft will really go forward. And I will have a hunger, and I will have a thirst, and I will have a concern, and I will have a time with you, a vital time with you in my life. Let us bow in prayer. Father, we started out by saying, pardon me, your attitude's showing. And Lord, we know our attitudes do show. And the people we work with, in our family, and you are very much aware of our attitude deficiencies. And Lord, I just pray that this checkup this week that we've gone through together, that we have been open to the Spirit of God and willing for Him to show us attitudes, our attitudes that are not been right or pleasing with you. And Father, I pray that you might just give us a deep purpose now and a very deep, sincere heart to deal with these attitudes. And that would be more than willing to get things right with you. We ask this in Christ's name. Amen.